course, my iPad's not working now. Come on. It's just this last conference. It's not that hard.
Sign of the times.
Sign of the times.
iPad stopped working.
It's true. This thing's just going to be a brick before too long.
Please bless our refreshments to give us strength in our bodies.
Hello, and welcome to Bless the Refreshments, where normal people have normal conversations about the gospel, making it way more fun and interesting to be a member of the church. So we all know how hard it is to wait for something. Waiting for that vacation you have planned next year, or waiting for the next episode of your favorite show to drop next week, or waiting for lunch plans you've made with your friends tomorrow. But at least you know when those things are going to happen, right? Now compare that to waiting for your non-Amazon online purchase to arrive, or waiting to find out the results of your medical test, or when will your teenager who's always late for curfew finally be home? Many apologies to my mom back in 2003. But waiting for something to come when you have no idea when it will actually happen is so much harder, isn't it? It's actually proven science. So, of course, the ultimate thing that we have to wait for is the second coming of the Lord. Luckily, he's given us signs and signals so we can know that it's soon. And that's what Burgess and Tyson are talking about today, the last days. What prophets have said about the last days, what that could look like today, and how to make sure you're prepared.
Well, tonight we're talking about the last days. It's a fairly broad topic. Although, one of the things we know it doesn't include is the second coming. We'll have to wait for the second coming. But the last days are happening right now, and we don't have to wait for that. So that's good, right?
Yeah. Our audience is used to waiting now. They're just going to expect, like, you know what? They're just not going to do it.
Right. Well, it never happens until you're not waiting for it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That's hey, there's a good point.
Something about a watched pot never boils, something like that.
Right. Yeah, I think that's in the scriptures.
So, in an hour when you think not.
Yeah.
But the last days is in a lot of ways equally interesting, and part of that reason is because a lot of it's already happened. And we can talk about it in the past tense, which is interesting. So there's a book out by Gerald Lund called The Second Coming of the Lord. And it's kind of a reinvention of his first book that was in print forever. I think it was written in the 60s or 70s, called The Coming of the Lord. And so he rewrote it. And one of the reasons he rewrote it is because of all of the things that were talked about as prophecy, but now we can talk about as being fulfilled. And I think that's incredibly interesting that in the space of, 50 years, that a lot has happened that we can now put in the history books, right? Or at least, if not in whole, in part. And to be witnesses to that, to one of the most amazing times in the history of the church, I think is a privilege. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very cool. And I mean, one question I have, though, is like, so how do we know if something happened? Like, is this more of like a, I guess we can get into this as we get into specifics of the things that have happened already. But like, how do we know something has happened already? How do we know that qualifies as like the event that the prophecy is referring to?
Interesting question. Very interesting question. Sometimes you don't know. And also in other times, things are partially fulfilled. They're obvious, but they may have like future fulfillment that kind of completes the prophecy. But you really have to have a spirit of discernment to know when something has been fulfilled. Sometimes the Spirit just speaks to you and you feel like this has happened. Now, a better way to know, or maybe not a better, an easier way to know, is when a prophet gets up on the pulpit and says it's been fulfilled.
Right. Right? That's pretty official. Yeah.
As an example, President Hinckley, I'm blanking on the exact date, but it was in the 2000s, I believe, said something to the effect that one of the prophecies in Joel relating to the last days has been fulfilled. And so to me, I think we can take that at face value. Now, having said that, even in that statement, I think some people have taken that too far, like to say that because he said that that prophecy in Joel has been fulfilled, that all of these other things have also been fulfilled by virtue of that. And so we just have to be careful how we interpret those statements. But prophets say things all the time, you know, and sometimes we gloss over them, right? So I think if we don't get any other lessons today, it's that we really need to pay very close attention to what the prophets and apostles are saying. And we're going to actually get into one that was just said a few days ago that has pretty profound meaning and impact on what we're experiencing in the last days, I feel like. But let's go ahead and dive into it.
Yeah.
So why are the last days important?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because in a way, we don't, like, obviously we don't know when the Lord's going to come again. We don't know how long the last days will last, right?
Correct.
And so in a way, they're not important because we just have to, as long as we're daily repentance, continuing to do our best, following the Savior, as long as we just keep doing that, it doesn't really matter, right? When they come, what the last days are.
That is scriptural. So, you know, the whole point of the gospel is that you can be at peace in a wicked world. And that's one of the main messages of the last days, is that the righteous need not fear. And that's true whether you're in the last days or whether you're in any other time. And so that is the simple, pure message that the world, by and large, rejects, that there is no safety in doing these things that you claim to be true. We're going to stick to our own things. We know best, and we just want what we want, and we're going to keep doing that. That also tends to devolve into persecution because, you know, you can have maybe a friendly disagreement for a time, but at some point, the two ideologies clash. And really, ultimately, there's only two, right? There's only two modes of belief. There is the true and living gospel, and then there's everything else.
And it's interesting how that those disagreements, a lot of the time, lead to anger, you know?
Right.
It's really interesting how that happens, that there's very little agree to disagree, and it really does lead to persecution, which I guess a lot of these prophecies talk about.
They do, because that's one of the first, maybe not one of the first, but one of the signs of the last days is universal apostasy. It talks in the scriptures about how the people of God were spread upon all the face of the land, which sounds nice, right? But then they clarify that, and their numbers were few. And that's a prophecy I feel pretty comfortable about being, if not in whole, in part fulfilled. We are a global church, and our members are upon all the face of the land. Even as we found out, you know, not to single out anyone, but, you know, President Nelson got pretty emotional when he announced a temple in mainland China.
Right.
And that's one of the most difficult places that we've had to preach the gospel, and to have some presence of membership there actually is a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And so all nations are hearing and accepting the gospel. Another trait of the last days. We believe in the literal gathering of Israel. Not this last conference, but the one before that, President Nelson got up and said, it's the most important thing happening right now. And, you know, it's one of the hallmarks of, you know, the closing of the seventh seal. Or excuse me, not the seventh seal, the closing of the sixth seal, excuse me. So what are some of the things that we know for sure have been fulfilled that have ushered in the last days?
Well, the church has been restored.
Correct. Right? Yep.
There's been a red moon. Well, talking about the gathering of Israel, is that something that's just going to keep happening until the Lord comes again? Or is there like a time where it's been gathered? Like, is that just like a continuing fulfillment? Because I feel like that's fulfilled, or continues to be fulfilled, because we're continuing to gather, right?
Right. And it depends on how you define gathering Israel. So, you know, Israel will continue to be gathered even after, you know, the second coming happens, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And as we found out, you know, the most important gathering happens in our own homes. That's, to me, a continual process throughout really through the end of the world, that Israel is God's people, those who covenant with the Lord to follow him and keep his commandments. And that will always happen as long as the world stands, because that's the whole point. But the keys of the gathering were given to Joseph Smith in the Kirtland Temple. And that's when officially, I guess you could say, that the gathering of Israel started in the last days. And so, yeah, so there's all those restoration things are part of the last days. Now, interestingly, you could say that there are some things like leading up to it that are signs of the times. Maybe not technically part of the last days, but certainly preparatory to it, like the Enlightenment, trying to find, you know, truth and the gospel and those types of things. But also during that time, the Bible was translated. The King James Version in particular was translated and is the one that we use today. So that kind of had to happen first. Having access to the Bible in the language that the gospel was going to be restored in was kind of a big deal. But then also after that, you know, having more to do with the restoration, we received the Book of Mormon. And that's more preparing a people, you know, for the Lord. Because without the Book of Mormon, and this is from a talk by President Nelson a while before he was prophet, I'm wanting to say it was back in 2006, but he said, without the Book of Mormon, the gathering of Israel could not happen. I mean, that's a really big deal. But when you go back and read some of the accounts that we have in the early days of the church, you know, Parley Pratt is an obvious one.
Right, yeah.
When he got wind of the Book of Mormon, and he, you know, talks about he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep. Sleeping was a burden. He couldn't do anything until he finished it. And so all of these things, you know, the Book of Mormon is what started to prepare our people to really receive the fullness of the gospel. And to me, is still a treasure, you know, that we have.
I think part of that, I think, is, you know, by their fruits ye shall know them, you know, because another one of the signs of the last days is the Antichrist, right? The false prophets.
Well, we need to...
Am I jumping too far ahead?
Well, no, you're not. You're actually... But I want to make a distinction, though. As this comes out of my mouth, I'm actually not sure that I'm right about it, but is an Antichrist the same as a false prophet?
Yeah, so I would... Because that subject's always been really interesting to me. From what I understood is they're mostly the same, but the scriptures do reference the Antichrist, like, and it doesn't seem like there's just going to be one. It seems like there's going to be, it's not like the Antichrist. Like, it seems like there's going to be a few. For a long time, I always thought there's just going to be this one, probably because of all the movies I've seen.
Right.
You know, but it looks like from what I've read, it seems like there's going to be a few, you know.
Yeah. They're going to be all over the place.
It even the scriptures talk about performing miracles. I use miracles in quotes, but
false miracles.
You know, yeah, right. Exactly. Right. So that would probably what distinguishes an Antichrist from a false prophet, you know?
Right. I think you're right. I think there is some overlap. I think maybe what can distinguish them is their methods in the Book of Mormon. But even then, you know, the Antichrist usually present themselves by preaching a false gospel. We see that with Sherem and others in the Book of Mormon. And so there's different names of it. So maybe to me, I'm not 100% sure on that. I think it might be a distinction without a difference, but it's something that I was thinking about as I was preparing for this. But the interesting thing is that a false Christ isn't necessarily a false prophet. A false Christ isn't a person. It's a false system of worship.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah.
And so, but that entails also false prophets, false ministers, false churches, right? Mm-hmm. That all kind of serve that purpose. To me, the interesting thing about false systems of worship is that I'm a believer that anyone who is a, you know, a humble and true seeker of God will eventually find the truth.
Yeah.
Even if it's not in this life, I think they'll eventually find it. But I think, having said that, that there also has to be people that are knowingly deceiving.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%.
And so, but to try and like say who exactly those people are all the time, I think is not that useful. but just to know that the person purporting the false systems of worship is the adversary. So what are some of the things going on in the world right now that make us pretty sure that the last days are well in force?
Well, I think the wars and rumors of wars is a big one, right?
Right.
Pestilence, which we probably haven't seen the worst of, most likely. What else? Famines, like how much of the world doesn't have access to clean water?
Right? A ton.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, for sure.
So,
Utah might not have access to water much longer.
That's a good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is an interesting thing. I feel like there's still a lot of people out there that believe that famine and drought just don't happen anymore.
Right.
Like we're too advanced to suffer those things.
And I think it's easy. Like if you get into a bubble, like with your running water and your utilities and all your water comes out of your pipes, like I can see how if you don't look too far from your
right
point of view, then it might be easy to think that, you know.
There is actually a really interesting documentary that I watched about areas that don't have access to like clean running water or running water at all. And it's not in third world countries. It's here. There's towns like people like taking bottled water to these places because they couldn't wash their dishes. They couldn't flush their toilet, you know, all of that stuff. They just didn't have access to it. And also how we kind of mask droughts by depleting aquifers underground, right?
Yeah, true.
Specifically, I think this documentary was pointing out California. And the interesting thing about California, I actually grew up there when I was younger. I grew up in Southern California. But like there was droughts there every year, you know, that I was growing up that I can remember. And there probably still is. You know, it's actually, even though the coast is pretty lush, like it's a cliche how it never rains there, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's true. It doesn't rain very much. And yet I don't feel like we ever rationed water that much, you know, at least nothing that was ever like in force. But a lot of that came from getting water from aquifers and doing those types of things. Because a lot of our crops come from California as well. And guess what? If we ever run out of water in California, that's going to be a big deal for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But can happen, right? We've not figured out a way to get around droughts. Or to be honest, it's interesting in Utah, while farmers do have more access to water than the rest of us, like in the last couple of summers, it's been really hard to grow like anything in your garden.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And you garden more than I do. So
yeah, we ran into a lot of, we try to do creative ways to keep it watered. But right. Yeah, we had, you know, maybe 70% of what we normally have this year, you know?
And I mean, does a pandemic qualify as pestilence?
Sure. I would think so.
You know, disease, I think, falls in line with, that's part of the plagues, right?
Right.
Yeah. It was amazing to me. If there was one image that I held like of the last days in my lifetime, it was driving to work in downtown Salt Lake City, and it was a ghost town.
Yeah.
Like there was no one on the streets. And I remember my boss telling me that he gave me a document to show police in case they pulled me over and asked me why I was out and about, that I was like an essential worker, right?
Right.
And like that was crazy to me, like that I had to show my papers.
Yeah.
You know, right. Potentially. I never got questions, so I don't want to make it too dramatic, but I was given that document. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Right? Yeah. I mean, the pictures we saw in New York City, you know, it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was all over the country. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's really like you're looking at that and you're like, wow, how fragile are we?
Yeah.
You know, it's a big deal. And we're still not to the big ones yet.
Right.
But let's keep going with some of the positive ones that we have. So more signs of the times. Temples. Temples will dot the earth. Specifically, the reason that temples exist, you know, Elijah comes and conveys keys the sealing keys to Joseph Smith and the Kirtland Temple, binding the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers, you know, fulfilling that promise, talking about Malachi. And so that's a big deal. But also, you know, just the rate that temples are going. I mean, we've got a little less than 200 operating temples, I think. And when you factor in the rate that they're, I mean, they're announcing about 20 a conference lately. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not going to take long to for that number to get a lot bigger.
Right. I mean, there's like, what, 54 under construction? Like, not just announced, but like under construction.
Right.
You know, so.
Not only that, but you remember, not necessarily trying to compare this temple to all the other ones, but the Salt Lake Temple took 40 years to build. And a lot of these temples are getting built in less than four.
Yeah.
And more simultaneously. So it's a pretty monumental task to do that. And, you know, a lot goes into it, but it really, when you see, so for instance, I went to the groundbreaking of the Linden Temple, which is the one that I'm working on. And it's really amazing to see the excitement in the eyes of the saints in those places and how it invigorates the work, because temples are, you know, heavily associated with the gathering of Israel, because that's the gathering of our kindred dead. And we all know that that gathering on both sides of the veil is intertwined. But yeah, so it's really interesting to me to see the increase in the number of temples and the impact that that has on the fervor within the church. Because while the last days are kind of, there's a lot of bad things that are going to happen, there is a galvanizing effect on the righteous.
Right. That's very true. That's a really good point. I mean, there's a reason that people cheer in during conference with the temple announcements, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, that's my temple, right?
Right, exactly.
And,
yeah.
And that's awesome. And no disrespect to the prophet, because I reverence his words, but he can say every conference from now until the end of the world, please don't make loud noises when your temple is announced, but like, they just can't help it, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of that, you know, there's so many places that have prayed for temples for so long.
Yeah.
You know, and then when they get it, it's just, yeah, it's probably just such a, it probably feels like some sort of relief, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In some place, especially in a remote place in the world that you have no idea. I mean, that's got to be such an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Then you got to wait 3 or 4 years before it actually gets there. And that, and, right. And that's got to be trying. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, the, I won't go into detail about this. I'll just say I know it happens. Wherever a temple is built, they actually involve all of the stakes, not in the like specific activities, but there's a lot of activities, missionary-like activities. So there's lots of service that's done. There's lots of, you know, ministering to people that are curious, taking visitors, those types of things. There's lots of things that the stakes are able to participate in and do while the temple is being built that keeps them engaged in that process. But it's really a fun thing to watch, because even though they're not like pouring concrete, you know, they're still a really integral and special part of that process. And I'm really glad that the church finds ways to make that a special experience for the people who that temple's going to serve.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like that.
But there are some downsides to the last days. And this really comes back to the parable of the wheat and the tares. Because if we go back to that, what's the reason why they have to let the wheat and the tares raise up together for a time before they separate them? The story goes that the reason they have to wait is because there's a chance when they're young, the wheat and the tares look very much alike, so as not to burn up the wheat with the tares, they have to let them grow up together. And as they mature, the distinction becomes very clear, as it is with people, right? So
yeah,
as we continue along the path of righteousness or sin, it becomes clear who we have chosen as our God. And so at the time that we're fully ripe is when the separation happens and the righteous are harvested into a state of glory and eternal life, and the wicked are burned, so to speak. Some literally, some figuratively.
Right. Yeah.
But that's the reason why there must be opposition in all things. One, it provides a testing ground for the righteous, but it also proves the wicked and allows them to receive a just judgment.
Right. Yeah.
So what are some of the specific events that we know are going to happen, like by name? I think the one that people know is Armageddon. So that's the great battle that happens before the coming of the Lord, and it's centered around Jerusalem.
We're talking like actual war, right? Like,
yeah, it's the biggest war the world's ever seen.
And see, to me, that freaks me out, because it's really not that hard to picture the largest war the world's ever seen around Jerusalem. The cultures around there, you know, every culture that holds Jerusalem as a sacred city, they're so serious, and their religion is such a huge part of their life that they will defend it with their life. And it's really not that far of a stretch to say that the biggest war that we've ever seen is going to be around there.
But it's interesting when you think of the biggest, there's been some really big wars.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And to think that it's going to surpass anything that we've ever known as a civilization is pretty scary, actually. You know, we're talking about millions and millions of deaths. And all war is bad, right? And war is actually one of the great evils that we're capable of, in the sense that, you know, so if we look at the Book of Mormon, and Mormon talks about the abominations that his people participate in connected to wars. So it's not bad enough that we kill them, but we do all kinds of other horrible things to the people that they conquer. And you can see that. That's not just the Book of Mormon. You can see that in the history of the world. Conquered people are right. slaves, and they're abused beyond belief.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can say that there are worse things than war, but war is the common thread, you know, that leads to those bad things. It's really, really bad. Another thing, actually, is maybe we put off Battle of Armageddon for just a minute, because Armageddon is actually one of the last things that happens before the second coming.
Right.
But secret combinations. I think people feel like they know what secret combinations are, but if you look throughout history, and especially in our present day, they can take on a lot of different forms. What are some of the ones that you feel like you've seen?
I mean, it seems kind of small, like, I don't want to say small in grand scheme of things, but like, you see so many businesses covering up their losses, you know, that's more on the smaller scale, like, but it still affects tons, like, depending on how big the business is, still affects people's lives, right?
Sure.
And then you get into governments working with, you know, you making back alley deals with shady people or whatever, mm-hmm. things like that.
Well, so that's really interesting, though. So I know there's plenty that happens behind the scenes, whether it be politics or anything else, you know, that are hidden out of sight that are evil. But the ones that I like to think about actually are the ones that are hidden in plain view. So talk about politics as an example. Have we seen politicians polarize society more in any time in our lifetime?
That's true. Doesn't seem like it.
Politicians are saying things now that they wouldn't have dared say 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it would have had to be more subtle. Now they can just say things. They can openly vilify any group of people that they want. And there's no repercussion to it. And so that's very interesting. I've actually, even though I'll still go and vote, I've actually personally withdrawn politically, just because I see it on all sides. This contention that President Nelson has asked us to get out of our lives. And that's a hard thing. If you read the Book of Mormon, you can't go very many verses without coming across the word contention.
Yeah.
And that's always a precursor to the struggles and the wars and other battles of the people that lead to suffering.
That's a good point. I guess I'd always thought of secret combinations as like literal secrets, but that's true. People, you know, anybody using that contention to their advantage, be like, oh, I can really rabble rouse here, and therefore my, you know,
right,
whatever will be accomplished, you know, so I'll just keep prodding them. And yeah, that's a good point. I thought of that as a secret combination.
I was reading Alma and Amulek the other night, and it's really interesting when Zeezrom comes up and starts questioning Amulek. I thought, oh, this is totally a politician, because he's like, I want to ask you a few questions. And the first question he says is, I've got these, I'm going to get the coinage wrong, but I've got these 5 aunties of silver, I think is what he has. And all of these will I give you if you will deny that there is a God. And I'm just like, that's not a question.
Right.
And then Amulek goes on to say what a subtle plan that he laid. And he tells him what he was thinking. And actually, it's interesting because he ends up being a means of converting Zeezrom after Zeezrom suffered, right? Zeezrom suffered. He realized his bad state, but the rest of the people didn't. They felt so justified in their vitriol against Alma and Amulek that they massacred the people that agreed with them.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Could that happen today?
Yeah, I don't think it's hard to see that, unfortunately.
Right.
The amount of anger that gets stirred up, you know, it's just like, you know, when you're just saying that, it's there's so little, you know, what they call high-minded debate. You know, there's very little debate that actually like uplifts both sides, you know?
Yeah.
It's all like, if you try to get into some sort of debate, it always ends up in like personal attacks on baseless claims, pretty much. That you just have to like back off. You can't even, like you said, you have to withdraw. You can't even be a part of it anymore, you know?
Right.
And so just with that amount of anger, it's really not that hard of a stretch to see that happening nowadays.
And it's interesting going back to, you know, thinking that we're so evolved, right? That we're above all of these things. You know, there's a part of, I think it was in Joseph Smith Matthew, and that's actually an excellent text to talk about the last days and the second coming and those types of things. It's really an interesting read. But one of the things that stood out to me is that, so there's kind of the earth in its lifetime will go through kind of 5 transformations, right? There was the creation that was created. The flood was the kind of the next transformation. The earth went under an upheaval during the Lord's crucifixion at the meridian of time. Then there's going to be the millennium where it's going to be cleansed the first time, and then it's going to turn into a celestial sphere. And that's actually a really good baseline for this transformations that we all go through in our road to exaltation. But speaking of the flood, in Joseph Smith Matthew, it talks about that people were eating and drinking, being merry until the day that the flood came, and they had no idea. And they essentially, what he's saying is, so also will it be at the coming of the Lord in glory. That's really interesting to me, because we know all these things are going to happen. These signs to those who believe and have faith will be obvious. I mean, we haven't even really gotten to the really bad stuff yet, and it's already obvious, I think, to a lot of us.
Yeah,
what's happening. But to think that the world is going to be in upheaval, millions and millions of people are dying, the waters are going to turn to blood, the sun, the moon, and the stars are going to be hidden from the skies. All of this is going to be going on around us, and people are going to be still like, yeah, let's just keep doing what we're doing.
Right.
But that, I think, shows us the power that we're able to give the adversary over us. If we can believe that, we can believe anything if we're not vigilant in nurturing our faith.
So we never really answered the question at the beginning of why this is important, like why learning about it is important. Would you say that that's the reason that knowing these signs is important, is that when things get terrible, like we can have that piece of this is part of the plan?
I think so. I mean, our gospel is a gospel of understanding and knowledge. So if the Lord gives us something, whether in scripture or by the words of the prophets or otherwise. He wants us to understand it. Part of the trouble we get in sometimes on a lot of different levels, not just with what we're talking about, is that we receive a little of something and we don't apply our understanding to it. We don't seek for understanding. We don't go to the Lord. So as an example, Nephi has an interchange after he is carried away in the spirit when he receives an interpretation of his father's dream. He comes back down and his brothers and his dad are having a, I don't know if an argument is the right word, but they're having a really hard time understanding the words that his father spoke to them. And he's coming down and he's saying, "Have you not inquired of the Lord?" And they say, "We have not, for the Lord makes no such thing manifest unto us." And Nephi connects that to their hard-heartedness, to their wickedness. How is it that you cannot keep the commandments of the Lord? And one of the commandments that we have, search these things. And why is that important? I think one of the main reasons is what you just described. How are we supposed to weather the storms of life if we don't have an understanding of how that plan is going to unfold, or also how the Spirit and how Christ works in our lives? If we understand that, we can withstand anything. That's why the prophet, I believe, has made such an important plea to the church to hear him, because it's such an integral part of how we weather the trials of life that are going to increase. And it actually leads to something, and I want to touch on this before we get too much further. All right, so President Nelson's talk Sunday morning was talking about overcome the world and find rest. So I'll say this just in preparation. This wasn't what I was looking for, but he says something I think is pretty interesting considering our current conversation. You can overcome the spiritually and emotionally exhausting plagues of the world, including arrogance, pride, anger, immorality, hatred, greed, jealousy, and fear, despite the distractions and distortions that swirl around us. You can find true rest, meaning relief and peace, even amid your most vexing problems.
That's perfect. I love that.
I don't think those words were on accident.
Yeah.
Just saying.
No, yeah, absolutely not. As much, I mean, it'll be, you know, the more we strengthen our testimony about these things and, you know, just the stronger our testimony is in the Savior, when all these terrible things are happening in the last days, as they continue to happen, as they continue to get worse, you know, the stronger our testimony is in the Savior, we can really look into our child's eyes with confidence, or to our neighbor's eyes, and say, everything's going to be okay. Even if we perish, even if we die, you know, everything's going to be okay.
You know, what's interesting about that statement is that sometimes in the scriptures, and I think I would get pushback on this on a case by case basis, but there's times in the scriptures, it's interesting that when righteous people who die in the faith, it's not pleasant what they're asked to go through, right?
Yeah.
But there are places in the scriptures where they say that their pains that they were called upon to go through were sweet to them. And the reason is because they felt it a privilege, say like Peter and John and Paul, to shoulder those persecutions for Christ's sake. You know, you think of Abinadi, you know, you think of Alma and Amulek. They were tortured in prison for days. They were delivered, but they had to go through that. And so I think there is an aspect to it. You know, those who are called to go through any number of trials are given strength. If they're faithful, they're given strength proportionate to the things that they're called upon to go through. And that is a theme of the last days. So here's what he says. My dear brothers and sisters, so many wonderful things are ahead in coming days. We will see the greatest manifestation of the Savior's power that the world has ever seen. Between now and the time he returns with power and great glory, he will bestow countless privileges, blessings, and miracles upon the faithful. Because as the world increases in wickedness, the spiritual power that supports the faithful must also increase. But just those two excerpts that I read really make you think about the ramping up of the events of the last days, do they not?
Yeah, especially that last one. I think a lot of us, myself included, focus a lot on the how scary the last days are going to be, you know?
Yeah.
But from those words you just read, that I think that's the really important part to focus on, is that there will be some truly incredible things that happen that just spread so much more joy around the world than ever has been.
There can be. And that's yeah. The great thing about it. There can always be joy, even on some of the things that we're going to describe. So as an example, if you go to Revelations, John talks about seven angels that bring with them seven plagues. So the first angel brings hail and fire descending upon the earth. The sea is smitten. The third one is the water is polluted. The fourth, the sun, moon, and stars are smitten. The fifth is more modern warfare. This is when Satan reigns heavily upon the earth. It talks about men shall seek death and not find it.
That's crazy.
Isn't it?
That's so crazy. Yeah. Like, I don't even know what that would look like, you know?
Right? Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So much of this world is about escape.
Yeah, that's true.
And when we go through something hard, you know, I'm going to go to this experience I had in graduate school one time. This person that I'm going to mention, a great person. Like, I've nothing against this person, but it was a little telling to me. So we had work to do. But there was occasionally events that, you know, college kids want to go to and have a good time or whatever, you know, that kind of a thing. And there was an event going on this evening, but I'm like, I've got work to do. I'm paying a lot of money to be at graduate school. I've got to get my work done, right? And we were on a team. And so I start kind of digging into the work and we're there together and we're starting to do it. And she looks at me like with this like pleading look on her face. And she looks at me and she's like, wouldn't you rather go drink? And it was kind of funny too, because I just look at her and say, I don't drink. And like the look of like utter defeat on her face was like the most funny thing I've ever seen in my life.
That's great.
But to her credit, she rolled up her sleeves and we got the work done. And I'm sure she went and crashed the party, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
But the thing that I think is that, you know, we do so many things as a society, alcohol, drugs, all kinds of bad behavior, because we're trying to escape, you know, the pain, right? Or we need relief from the drudgery and things like that. And it's been amazing to me. I've gone through my fair share of disappointments and trials and things like that, but never do I feel like I need to hide or escape something. You know, I feel like I've got purpose. You know, I feel like the things that I do have meaning, and that there's really happiness to be had, even though it's not easy sometimes. What about you? What do you feel? I mean, there's got to be moments of discouragement, right?
Well, like, full disclosure, my instinct is to hide. And a lot of it is like there's certain abuse from my childhood. There's certain other things that's like, but like, especially like personal conflict, you know,
yeah.
My instinct is to run, is to, whatever that looks like, is to escape and not feel whatever this feeling is, you know?
Sure.
And unfortunately, like, I've been learning more and more that if you shut out the bad feelings, you shut out the good feelings too. You can't just shut one feeling out. Like, if you shut out the bad, you're going to shut out the good and just shut out all feeling, you know? You know, so that's something that I really do have to practice, sitting with being uncomfortable, sitting with a certain amount of pain, whether like mentally, or I feel like I can handle physical pain a lot better because I know what to do.
Right.
Like, I know how to heal. But like with mental discouragement, with, you know, any sort of mental trials, like, my instinct is to escape from it, is to shut it out, to do what I can to not think about it. And so I do go that direction, and it does, like, if, and I can sympathize with the people that go towards the escape, because it's once you have gotten into that habit enough, it's hard to get to not do it anymore.
Right.
Thankfully, the brain is plastic and you can train your brain to sit with the uncomfortable feelings. And that's something that I still need to practice, but it's hard. It's like working out. You know, you got to do the hard stuff. It's going to be really hard first training your brain to do something new.
Yeah. You got to get your reps in, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, there's a lot of pain that comes with it, unfortunately, but like they tell me it's worth it.
No. And we all go through that, right? You know, right. We all have those moments where we're like, is this really worth it?
Right.
And I think that's where grace comes in. We're not expected to be perfect, and you know, that you're able to be vulnerable and say, yeah, this is really how I feel. That's not a sign of weakness. That's a sign of maturity, right? To say like, yeah, I see those tendencies in myself, and I also see that I'm doing the best that I can to work through it. And also just like, I think gives other people that are going through something similar, someone to look to like, oh yeah, it's not just me. I see that so much. Everyone thinks that they're by themselves.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
And I can't say all I want to say about this because I obviously, you know, I need to be mindful of the people who have given me confidence about things, but there's so many people out there that just finding out that there's other people going through the same thing, you should see the relief on their face.
Yeah.
And it is like we're able to comfort each other that way by saying like, yeah, you know, I've gone through that too, or I'm going through it right now, or whatever the case may be. That's the other thing too, is being willing to comfort each other. That's like a part of the gospel, right?
Right. Yeah. A big part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sharing one another's burdens that they may be light. But yeah, no, I think you're right on though. That was excellent. But let's keep diving. There's just to talk through some of the events that we haven't gotten to yet. So we left off the modern warfare, but then we get into Armageddon, which is the really big one. And Armageddon will be a religious war in nature. All nations will be gathered together to Jerusalem to battle. So it's going to be, yeah, it's going to involve the whole world, which will be nuts, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not hard to, this is one of those that's not hard to imagine though, because for whatever reason, Jerusalem, Israel seems to be something that we can all agree to fight about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's very true.
Right.
I mean, what, like the three of world's biggest religions, Jerusalem is the sacred city.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah, for sure. And so it's a big, you know, it's a big thing. And during Armageddon, a whole nother sea of plagues, you know, comes out right at the end. Like it's even worse than the seven plagues that preceded it. And at the tail end of that, Christ comes. Now, there's other things that go along with that. So as an example, in Jerusalem, while all this havoc is going on, they're going to send two prophets there. And they're going to preach for 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. Then at the end of that, the people of the city are finally going to kill them, and they're not even going to bury them. Their bodies are going to lay in the streets for 3.5 days. And then they're going to be called up into heaven after that. And after that happens, they're going to have a great earthquake and a great part of the city will fall during that. So lots of things connected with that. But it's interesting too, because if you're watching, now watch, I'll for sure be proved wrong about this. So just if for no other reason, just because I say it. But Bruce McConkie, in one of his books, talks about that these two men are almost certainly going to be either the prophet, the first presidency, or the Quorum of the 12 Apostles will be chosen from those groups, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And so I can't imagine a way that this is going to be a secret.
Right.
Right. And so like when these two people go and start preaching in the city, you can like start your clock.
Right.
You've got exactly 1,260 days.
So is that about 4 years, 3.5 years?
3.5 years, the same length as Christ's mortal ministry. And so it's really interesting the connection that the events of the last days have to events in the past. Like you can connect, as an example, the plagues of Egypt with the plagues of the last days. There's a lot of similarities right there. the two prophets are going to preach the same length as Christ did in his mortal ministry. That's another kind of parallel. I'm very excited personally to see the parallels that are going to happen in the Book of Mormon. So as an example, when the Nephites were about to be slain by the unbelievers because the sign didn't come, are we going to see a parallel of that in the last days? Would not surprise me one bit. And we know that the Book of Mormon was written for our time. And so all of the parallels that we see there, I think I'm very interested to see where those will be manifest. Also, one of the signs of the times that we haven't talked about too much, we talked about Noah, but we didn't talk about the bow in the cloud or the rainbow. So we know, as an example, that the rainbow will not appear in the year that the Savior will come.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, why won't it appear?
It's because there's no rain?
Maybe. It might be for, it, you know, because we know that droughts can still happen, right?
True. I mean, if the sun and the skies are scorched or whatever it says, if there's no light coming through, then...
Yeah, no sun, no rainbow, right?
Right. That's true. That's a good point.
So, and we know that that is one of the last plagues, right? That the sun's going to hide its light. For what reasons, we don't know. A lot of people have speculated about like different types of bombs and things that can really wreak havoc on nature and stuff like that. Who knows what it's going to be? But
it's so the machines can't use solar power.
Right. That's true.
We scorch the skies,
right? Oh, man. But we know, maybe to kind of put a button on it, that one of the first things that Moroni said to Joseph Smith when he came is a term that he used was the time soon cometh. And that is a direct fulfillment of the prophecies about the last days. And it's been in a borderline obsession of our people ever since the founding of the church. The apostles, Christ's apostles, like he hadn't been crucified very long at all. And he's like, oh, when are you going to come back? Right. And so it's really been at the center of our thought forever. But why is that? Why is that important?
I think that's a really good question, because I think a lot of it is some sort of sense of fulfillment, sense of reward, sense of rest, I guess. I don't know. I think part of it is just being mortal. We look towards there's an end of everything, you know?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is that.
And there's a phrase in the scriptures that always comes to mind for me. They will not be ashamed that wait for me. You know, we talked about this last time, waiting on the Lord. Mm-hmm. Really fortuitous that we had that as a precursor to what we're talking about today, because the last days are all about waiting. The act of waiting that we were talking about, right? You know, and it's not singular to the last days either. At any time in the world, anyone who's working out their salvation has to wait. And it's an important part of the gospel. There's seasons of peace and there's seasons of struggle. You know, there's seasons of servitude and there are seasons of liberation or deliverance. And all of those things point us to Christ. Because what are we waiting for? We're waiting for Christ. That's been one of the great, joys of my life, has been to realize, Tyson, what are you waiting for? And is that struggle worth it? Because it's a struggle. We need to be patient and we need to continue to exercise faith and diligence in keeping the commandments. We need to be constant, to use one of the terms of our beloved hymns, we need to be constant unto him. And it's only after that we receive the witness that we seek after the trial of our faith. And the trials of the last days are going to be nothing to sneeze at. But as President Nelson talked about this last conference, the privileges and the rewards and the gifts and the strength given to the faithful are unlike anything that we're going to have seen in the history of the world. And it's because of what we're called to pass through. There's another song that we have. It's a verse out of how firm a foundation. As thy days may demand, so thy succor shall be. And that's, to me, that's kind of the last days.
Yeah. It's going to be pretty demanding days.
What about you? What is it that the last days mean to you, ultimately?
Well, honestly, I think the better answer to what we said of why they're important, I think you just said it is like, this is another thing that points to him, right? We learn about this because it's another thing that points to Christ. And honestly, like it seems to be a favorite subject for members of the church, whether, you know, and the various knowledge about it or exaggerations about it vary from from great to little.
Right.
I haven't spent a whole lot of brain power thinking exactly about what, you know, what's going to happen in the last days. Just like certain specific subjects here and there, like the Antichrist, where we talk, you know.
Right.
But they haven't meant a whole lot to me. They haven't been a huge part of my life. But I like what you just said, because I think that it is another thing that points to him. These are events that, whether outwardly or inwardly, we can see that literally point to him coming. And I really like that. It makes me want to dive more into it, learn more about it.
Absolutely. And we will dive in and learn more about it when we do our episode on the second coming. Sometime. When it comes. As a thief in the night.
So, what are your feelings about living in the last days? Did we miss any signs? And what do they look like to you? How are you living in the last days to make sure you're prepared for the second coming? We'd love to hear what you think, so email us your thoughts at blessthrefreshments123@gmail.com.
Please bless us to get home safely.